For members only. Golf Smarter number 326, published on March 27, 2012.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Golf's biggest delusions with Wall Street Journal columnist John Paul Newport.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, John Paul.
Yep, great to be here.
And thank you for sticking around for part two of this conversation about your article. And we've just covered numbers one and three. So I'm just going to skip around on these. Before we get there, I'm curious, when you write a column like this, what is the assignment for you? How much time do you get? Or do you say, oh, I'm going to do an article like this?
They're all my ideas. I mean, that's the hardest part, or the key part, maybe not the hardest part.
Well, I can see how that would be hard.
The most fun. But so I just come up with these ideas. That's the biggest part of my job assignment, is to come up with interesting topics to write about.
So they don't have an assignment editor on these columns, since you're not a reporter.
No. You have to. Well, come I up am with a reporter. I mean, I'm a reporter, but this is my job, is to come up with.
And so, how much research time do you spend before you sit down and start typing? Because clearly, on each of these points that you write, you've talked to somebody. Like we just finished on the last episode, when talking about Scotland, you talked to somebody over there, Hamish Gray, chief executive of the Scottish Golf Union, about pace of play there.
Mm-hmm.
How much research do you do?
Well, it depends on the article. Mm-hmm. I travel a good bit, so when I'm interviewing people at different places, that's the research. Usually, if I have all my information in place, it would take a full day to write the thing, as hard as that might be for people to understand. And then usually a polish the next morning. So if I have to do one a week, that leaves the rest of the week to come up with the ideas, to arrange travel, to do travel, to do calls on the phone, report, read books, read the web, whatever I need to do for that particular idea.
Play golf?
Well, that's ideal. But
do you get to play it very often?
I do play a lot in the spring. I like to play. Mm-hmm. I like to play in like amateur competitions,
and
arrangement with my wife where I'm allowed to spend a lot of time on golf, April, May, June, kind of to get everything together. And that's when my enthusiasm's the greatest for playing too, after a winter of pent-up demand. And I usually put my clubs up completely for 6 months a year.
Do you really?
Yeah.
I could. Well, see, living in California, I don't have to worry about that. But
I
did it one season a couple of years ago. I ended the season with some elbow issues, and I thought, I'm just going to try to do what they do in these and just force myself to not play. I was going crazy. Actually, nobody wanted me to be around the house.
Well, that's I enjoy it for some reason. I like the vacation from playing. I guess because I'm always writing about golf anyway.
Yeah.
And then about this time of year, there's a lot of pent up demand.
Yeah, we're about to have the clocks change and light during later in the day, and the best time.
I can't wait to get back out there.
Yeah, yeah. Did you play competitively when you were young?
No.
So this competitive thing is as an adult.
Yeah, I played. I played just a little bit when I was a kid, like seventh and eighth grade. I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, and there were really only two sports in Texas when I was growing up, and that was football and spring football.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Texas. It's all about
that's
football.
That's where I put all my emphasis on playing football. But seventh and eighth grade summers, some moms would take us out. There were four or five of us, the Muni at the edge of town, and we'd play. So I had a little bit of a feel for the game, but I didn't really take it up until my 30s. I probably hadn't played but 20 rounds of my life before I was struck dead by it.
Yeah.
I was 33 or something. 32.
Right. And here I am doing a podcast for the same basic reason. It's like I got struck dead. I was like, I need to ask people questions. I have so many questions. Wait, I'm a recording guy. I can interview them. I ended up with a podcast. 7 years later, I'm still doing the podcast.
Yeah, I just sort of drifted into golf writing because I was so enthused by playing it. And mm-hmm. I became a freelance writer, and I hadn't written sports at all. But it was a great subject, too, to write about because there's so many different elements to it, the emotional, the mental, the...
Well, I think that's why, like, golf books, golf movies, golf movies. There's certain sports that do work, you know, that translate well to the written word or visual. You know, baseball seems to, golf seems to. Football, not so much. Basketball, not so much. You know, like boxing does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certain things that work and certain that doesn't.
Golf works great in written word. I think it's not as successful in movies because it's hard to portray the mental machinations that are going on in a movie.
Yeah, Golf in the Kingdom. There's a good example for that. They finally, after 30 years, they finally produced a movie, came out this year, and from what I understand, I didn't get to see it, but I did not hear good things about it.
You have to, I talked to the producer about that and the director, and it's an art movie. You have to understand that it's an art movie. And if you go in with that expectation, I think it's a fun movie to watch, but it's not intended to be a Hollywood mass-produced, you know, like Bull Durham or
Tin Cup
or something.
The greatest game
ever played. It
belongs
in the little art movie in the bohemian section of your town, along with French cinema.
Right,
That's the kind of movie it is.
Did you read the book The Match by Mark Frost?
Yes.
I hope that's a movie sometime.
Yeah,
I thought that was
great.
He actually came on the show and after I read the book, I was so blown away by the book. And when he came, when I said, "Okay, tell the story," I won't ask any questions, just talk. And he's got such a beautiful voice, and it was what a great story that was.
I wonder if Cypress Point will allow them to shoot the movie there.
Not if it means
doubtful.
Yeah, doubtful, very much. So, what's your index?
About a 4.
Wow. Good for you.
Yep. I love it.
Well,
that's one reason I got involved in it and took it up is because I sort of had a knack for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes anything more enjoyable when you kind of have a knack for it.
Well, that brings me to point number 3 of your article. I do come back to these things. ADD is severe, but I do come back to these things. You're saying that a 10 handicapper should shoot 10 over par. Now, handicap, rating, slope. I know that we look at these things, but I don't know if anybody really knows what they mean.
It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
It's true. Most people that aren't golfers or have a vague awareness of golf, if you tell them you're a 10 handicap.
Or a 4.
They say, oh, so you shoot 10 over par. If it's a par 72 course, you're going to shoot an 82 on average. But that's not what handicaps are meant to capture. They're meant to capture your potential to shoot a good round. So in a competition with other people, they predict where if you shoot your best round, how well you might score. They're only based, as most golfers who have handicaps know, on the 10 best of your most 20 recent rounds. So already the average that they predict is just your best scores. Then that's tweaked according to certain formulas incorporating the difficulty of the course that you happen to be playing in both a slope fashion and a course rating fashion. And it produces an average that you should shoot on average once every 5 rounds. That score or better. So it's an aspirational score more than it's a average score.
Yeah. And I think that's another issue that people – don't really understand about golf that, you know, especially people who are starting the game think they're going to get better every time they come out and play. And you've got to accept the fact that, as you said, you know, every 5 rounds, just every round, you can go 10, 12 strokes either direction on any given day.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why they play four rounds in a row in a tournament.
Although, you know, if you have an accurate handicap based on, you know, your real recent scores, you don't really vary as much as you'd think. I don't think you really do go 12 strokes in either direction from your average score, not your handicap score.
Okay,
but your average
score. My average. Okay, yeah. So what do you think? Five or six strokes?
Yeah, more like okay. 3 to 5 strokes in either direction is
depending on your handicap.
Right, depending on your handicap.
Right,
I mean, you can go beyond that, but there's a bell curve where very few of your scores are really going to be beyond 3 to 5 strokes in either direction from your average score, not your handicap, but your average score.
When you go to a new golf course, well, I guess if you're a 4, you're going to play from the back tees no matter what. But
oh no, it's no reason to play from the back tees. It's
okay,
not any fun from the back tees.
No, it's not. Well, unless you use it to your advantage, because if you would normally play, say, the white tees, if it's blue, gold, white, let's just say it's that way, and you usually play the white, and you're going to hit yourself into the bunker, into the water, but if you move all the way back, you're not going to reach that trouble.
Yeah. Well, you should play, this tee it forward movement, which is out there now that the USGA and the PGA of America are pushing, is absolutely brilliant. And the idea is that what you want to do, you want to play from the tees that create the approach shots into the green that are the most fun to have.
Oh,
which would be,
I like
which would
this.
Be, which would be the approach shots where you're using sort of the same club that maybe the pros would be using into their greens. So on a long par 4, 480 yards on the PGA Tour, most of the pros are using pitching wedges to 8-irons into the greens. Now, they hit those pitching wedges and 8-irons farther than we hit our pitching wedges and 8-irons. But so to have the maximum amount of fun, the greens are created to accept shots, with the risk rewards with a wedge or a 9-iron or a 7-iron at the most. And so you're going to have a lot more fun. It's going to be a lot less frustrating if you're hitting shots into greens with the appropriate clubs those greens were designed for. You're going to be more likely to get on the green, have birdie putts, have reasonable pars. So you figure out, where the tees you should be playing are to give you those type of shots. And for most people, it's way far further forward than where they tend to play because they want to see the whole course. So then they're hitting 3 woods into those, or getting into the par fours or 2-irons or getting there in 3, and it's not nearly as much fun.
Too much tension.
There's something in the mentality that golfers are used to, playing as far back as they can, and they're really cheating themselves.
Right.
They really are from not having.
So when you get to a course that you've not played before, what factors do you review to help you determine which tee you're going to play from?
Well, I am a 4 handicap, and I'm 6'4", and I just happen to be pretty long hitter for me. So it's not like I find I enjoy courses around 6,500-6,600 yards. I can hit a pretty decent, 230, 250 yard, 260 yard tee shot if I hit it pretty well. I really can do that.
Yeah, sure you can.
Well,
we're going to lead into that one.
We're going to get to, but
next.
But I think I really am a little bit unusual because most people don't hit it that far, and I'm not bragging. It's just the way I am. So I look for tees generally that are around 6,500 yards. Most people, in reality, most men, 18 handicappers, should be playing courses that are much closer to 6,000 yards to have the maximum amount of fun and competition and, that they'd enjoy golf a lot more from those distances.
See, now for me, I like to what I think is compare apples to apples. So I will look at the rating slope of a golf course, especially the slope,
mm-hmm.
and that helps me determine what tees I'm going to be playing from. Because yardage, I have 2 courses that I play regularly here in Marin County. One is much longer than the other, but the shorter one, if you don't have a good short game, you're going to be on a green that's going to require 3, maybe 4 putts.
Mm-hmm.
if you can't get close enough to the hole on your short game, and it's a shorter course, but it's all about having a very strong short game and mental game.
Yeah.
So
well, that's very smart. That's exactly how you should think about it.
Yeah, I don't look at the yardage. I just don't get that part.
Because those greens were designed to be the challenge of that course, it sounds like, is in the greens. And so you really want to be hitting into those greens with clubs that you can control enough to put it in the right part of those greens rather than just reach the greens.
So I've not heard, I've not heard about tee it forward. Who's doing? I want to do a whole thing on that.
Well, it's great. Well, the guy you should have on is Barney Adams, who's the started Adams Golf. He's retired, although now that Adams Golf was recently
purchased by
he's now in the interim CEO. But it was his idea, basically, sort of like I explained it just now.
Yeah. I love that explanation.
And he put out a white paper last year and called around, advocated. I wrote a column about it, among other people. You know, he wanted publicity for it. He's a sort of a statesman of the game. Doesn't have a vested financial interest in this at all. He's retired as Adam's CEO. But the PGA of America and the USGA both agreed with him and teamed up. They don't usually team up on things, and they're supporting it. There's a week every summer or a month where they are asking courses to emphasize it and put up posters and, you know, just put tees in the ground where people, you know, could be playing from. And it's even Barney says it's going to take 5 years at least for the attitudes to change and people to understand that they really will have more fun playing golf from these appropriate tees. But it's just hard. People, you know, you pay your money, you want to see the full course, or there's just the male, usually it's the male ego that just wants to
worst
play
part of it.
Stupidly long tees that they just, it just, it makes golf not as much fun.
Right.
And it makes it last longer and makes people quit.
Yep. You said there's a white paper that he wrote. Can I Google that and find it?
Yeah, you should be able to find that.
I will definitely do that. And it leads me now, part of your conversation leads me into one of your other huge delusions, and that is, you write, quote, I hit my drives about 270 yards. I love your first comment. Ha!
All right. It's really true. I mean, that's people probably have hit a 270-yard drive in their lifetime.
Downhill with the wind at your
back. A lot of people, yeah. I think I wrote it downhill with the wind behind you on a bone-dry fairway.
You said, a rock-hard fairway when the ball bounced off a cart path and and a squirrel advanced it an extra 10 yards.
Right. So that's what people remember, you know, and they say, well, that's how far I hit my drive. Or 250. I mean, a lot of people think, you know, I hit 250. I carry at 250, you know. But Dave Peltz, the short game guru, borrowed the full PGA Tour Shot Link equipment system and software and has camped out for, I think it's the 4 years now, at the Myrtle Beach World Amateur Pro Tournament, where they have 3,000 amateurs competing every, can't remember what month it is. The good thing about that is they flight people according to their handicap. So they had, you know, a course. There are many courses that are used, but like this course on this day is only 10 handicappers and 20 handicappers on another day, and another course, 30 handicappers and scratch players. They have them all. And over 4 or 5 years, he's accumulated data on thousands of amateurs playing in these tournaments. And it's the same realistic to the inch measurements that the PGA Tour uses in its Shot Link system for the pros, determining how long they hit their drives and their accuracy on approach shots. And he has compiled the numbers, and he found out how far various handicapped golfers actually do hit their drives, and it's brutal. People are going to be very disappointed when they hear it. I assume you and your listeners would like to hear.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. This is great conversation for the golf course.
The average 30 handicap capper hits his drives or her drives 166 yards.
Oh, my.
20 handicappers average.
And those are the ones that will tell you that that's what they hit their 5-iron.
Right, probably. 20 handicappers average 183 yards. Mm-hmm. 10 handicappers average 214 yards, And scratch amateurs, these are your club champions, average 235 yards off the tee. And using that same methodology, the PGA Tour pros averaged last year 291 yards just by, you know, the same system of data collection.
Hmm.
So that's the brutal truth of the matter.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, buddy. Like we needed that.
There are a couple of caveats. One is, in all the years that he has been measuring, there was one 30 handicapper that had a recorded drive of 272 yards. So that proves the point. You know,
it can be done.
It may have been a kid that didn't know how to play very well, but you know, was long, and it can be done. So it's not like you won't hit that. And I think the 166 yard average for 30 handicappers may be skewed by just awful. You know, a topped drive that goes 30 yards. That's probably in the database. So it's you know, the median would probably be a more interesting number, which he didn't provide.
Right. Are those drives that go 150 yards this way and 70 yards that way?
Well, now, this isn't compared to accuracy. If they go 166 yards dead left, that records that.
So. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's the truth that people just don't hit the ball as long as they think they do.
You actually, in that point that you were making, you threw one in under your breath, which I thought could have been a whole different point. I want to make sure that I was reading this correctly. And you said, on no subject are golfers, especially male golfers, more deluded than on distance. They hit their drives, with the possible exception of their attractiveness to beverage cart personnel. So you're saying that she likes me, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, she thinks I'm hot. Yeah, and you start flirting.
You know those hot young college girls are attracted to overweight middle-aged men. You just know it.
Who smell like, you know, old cigar smoke and beer.
Right.
Crusty beer. Very funny. Very funny piece. So then you get into a couple I want to go to this one first, that business people play golf so that they can make deals on the course. And we talked about this a long time ago on the show, and that is really false. You don't do deals on a golf course.
Yeah, business golf is designed or serves its best function when you get to know somebody. It's about building relationships. That's what it's about.
Yep.
And it's great. You in this harried world, very seldom do you get four or five relaxed, fun hours outdoors with somebody that you can get to know as on a golf course. And there's usually a meal involved before or afterwards. It's a friendship, or even if it's not a friendship, it's a relationship, and you learn a lot about them. For better or for worse, can work both ways, certainly. And then once you have a relationship, you understand each other, you know who each other is, then you can pick up the phone later and you have a basis calls get returned. And
well, it's so true that nothing exposes character more than a round of golf. And the way, as a self-employed person, the way I take advantage of business on the golf course is I'm going to go out and play with this person and decide if I want to do business with this person and watch
right.
the way they play and you know, watch their attitude, watch their language, you know, how short their fuse is, all these things. It's like, do I really want to do business with this guy? Because I'm not liking the way he's handling himself here today.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're already doing business with them, then you know what maybe to watch out for, what to be a little wary of. And it works the other way. Say, this is a guy I can really trust.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's a great point. Again, another delusion that non-golfers have about golf. I think that I would think that most golfers understand that it's just there's no time to talk about business when you're on the golf course.
Right, right.
You're talking about your last shot and your next shot. And rarely are you listening to the other guy talk about his last shot or his next shot.
Right.
You're always talking about your own.
Yeah, that's one of the other truisms, is that you should never be embarrassed about a shot you hit, because nobody really was paying any attention.
Like if you hit this 180-yard shot that, carried the sand and the water and landed softly on the green, rolled and is 6 feet away, and you're totally stoked. And this guy, you know, chunked it and it rolled 18 feet to the left, and that's all he wants to talk about. You go, yeah, but I had that. I don't care.
There was a famous story about Ben Hogan. I can't remember who he was playing with, but he played the number 12 at Augusta in the Masters round. And I think the other guy maybe hit a hole in one, or hit it to like 1 inch, or I think he hit a hole in one. And Hogan said nothing about it. And I can't remember the story, but as they were walking off, the other guy said something. And Ben Hogan said, interesting hole, huh? And Hogan said, yeah, I've never, you know, I don't two-putt that hole very often. just about him. He hadn't even noticed the hole in one.
Right, exactly. What about me?
I told that story really bad.
I'm not going to edit it, though. And then you talk about Ben Hogan, and one of the things that seems to be talked about, especially on this show, it's so interesting. One of the things that I do about this show is when I bring golf instructors on, I found that most golf instructors feel that they have found the secret, that they know the key that's going to make every golfer better, and they're absolutely 100% convinced they are right. So what I try to do is say, look, I'm going to give you the soapbox. You climb on board and you scream out as loud as you want saying what your method is. I'm not going to judge you. I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm going to let the audience decide for themselves if they think you're full of crap or that you're for real. And so many times have we heard people say that I have discovered Ben Hogan's secret.
Yeah. Well, they may have, because there were a lot of Ben Hogan secrets.
Right.
He had secrets, if you want to call it that, but they weren't really that secret, because he let them out over the years, different ways and different places. And the other main factor, though, is that those were the secrets that worked for Ben Hogan, and they may work for you, but the final word, as far as I'm concerned, about Ben Hogan's secret, it's what he said himself, and which you've heard 1,000 times. This is the secret's in the dirt. And he meant he found it by hitting, you know, learning what he needed, how he started off with an awful hook. He figured out how to solve that hook, hit a controlled flight that didn't really even fade, just kind of moved a little bit left to right. But by in the dirt, he hit thousands and thousands, millions of balls, and he found out what worked for him. And that's the secret, really.
Is what works for you.
What works for you.
Yeah, that is the secret.
And it's going, and you've got to, and there's no way to get there without working hard to find it. And it can include some instruction, some work with the teacher. But actually, what I wrote my column about last week was about how hard it is that a 30-minute lesson where they tell you what works is not really going to be effective at all, because it's all of learning a new thing is all about taking it from this concept and making it part of your being. And the pros, you hear them say, well, I'm making a swing change and it's going to take a year to work it into my system. That's the way it works for the pros. They understand themselves better and how knowledge is passed along.
And they're playing all day long, every single day.
Right.
And it takes them at least a year. I mean, we've watched Tiger go through swing changes and how long it's taken for it to succeed, if it even has.
What does happen in a lesson is if you're, say, slicing an instructor, a good instructor, even not so good instructor, it's pretty obvious to them why you're slicing. They can tell you a thing that will help you slice less, you know, might reduce a 25-yard slice to a 12-yard slice, and at the end of that lesson, you're probably going to be slicing 12 yards instead of 25 yards. They can make that change. They can fix something, but I talked to some people for this article and experts on neuroscience and the way people learn and bring these things into themselves, and there's no chance that's. You don't understand anything. You haven't gotten anything. It's all about bringing that into your game, and it takes lots of different types of practice, smart practice, practice that's not really fun, not just hitting balls, but hitting balls in different circumstances, hitting balls in different lies, hitting, you know, coming at it many, many different days from different perspectives, hitting it in ways like on one leg or things where you're failing, but you're beginning to understand the move. You know, so there are many, many pathways that, your brain can attach to it and bring it forward rather than just a memory of one range session. And then over time, it becomes second nature. But it's necessarily and absolutely a long process, and people underestimate that. And they think that if they fix it on the range after a lesson, they're going to get that they've got it, and they don't have it.
And then we're deluged by training aids, products, mm-hmm. Golf Channel, Golf Digest,
right?
Magazines, newspapers. There's just so much YouTube. There's
right.
so much content bombarding us on how to improve, and yet it may not be relevant to what we do at all.
It's distracting. It's
totally distracting. That's the word I'm looking for.
If you get a good lesson or good tip, I mean, a tip can be useful,
yep.
but you have to integrate it. And you're going to get madly frustrated before it becomes second nature. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to see another tip, and you're going to substitute that tip for this tip, and you know, you're never going to get better.
And that's part of the problem that I have with this show is that I'm doing interviews every week, and I'm getting all these great little tidbits and tips, mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh, I should. Oh no, wait, don't do that. Just stop.
They're not wrong.
No,
most
no.
That advice you get is not wrong.
Nope.
It's just that it's like step one of 100 in order to get better. It's, mm-hmm. It's just the first step. What you need is. So one of the terms for it is deliberate practice, where you're working on, you know, one aspect of something, or in the total look of your game, you know, the thing that you're worst at, not the thing you're best at. When people go to the range, they often, you know, hit 100 balls of the thing they're best at, and which doesn't really help you learn it.
My favorite is when they pull out the driver first thing. It's like, really?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. It's just not. You look at the way the best coaches have their. What people, one of the, this guy named, there's a wonderful book I can recommend.
Please.
This guy named Rick Jensen wrote a book called.
S-E-N or S-O-N?
It's J-E-N-S-E-N.
Okay.
And it's called, Easier Said Than Done.
Okay.
And it, basically what he's saying is that the whole paradigm of how people learn is just wrong, and it's what people need is not instructors; they need coaches. The way they have coaches in other sports, you have to get like in other sports, football, basketball. Very little is on how to do something. It's all about sending them out to scrimmage, watching them in practice. You know, in the heat of the moment. You know, giving drills that can make these things work. You know, it's not like the actual technique of shooting a basketball. It's coaching. And he says that's the paradigm that golf needs to switch to if people are really going to improve. So and it's possible. The idea would be maybe you'd get your local pro, you get a lesson, but you and they would be happy to do this, but golfers don't ask for it, generally speaking. And you maybe have one or two less, you know, a month, but then they give you drills, they interview you after you've played and where you failed. They give you lots of on-course practice if you can find ways to hit from rough, and you know, lots of drills of the type that aren't much fun to do. But if you really want to get better, that's what it's going to take. And it's not learning, you know, more than one new thing every month. It's learning one new thing and then practicing it in lots of different ways until it becomes second nature to you.
And the book is called Easier Said Than Done, The Undeniable Tour-Tested Truths You Must Know and Apply to Finally Play to Your Potential on the Golf Course by Dr. Rick Jensen.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Very good. Very good book.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for the recommendation. So you had 9 things that people say about the game that aren't true and one that is. We've covered 6 of them. I want to I'm going to skip a couple of those tour-related myths and go right to number 10, the one that you feel is the truth.
Drive for show, putt for dough.
Yep.
Yep, that really seems to be the case.
Yeah, really, enough said, huh? but no, you I had actually, to do some research on that.
Yeah, I did. I actually had the tour ShotLink people run some data for me specifically.
How cool is that?
And they found that there's a new putting statistic called putts gained putting, strokes gained putting, which is a terrific statistic. They just started it last year officially, and it's basically compared to the fields playing in any tournament that day at that tournament, and because they have these shot links, they record, you know, from every inch how far people are putting and the results of each putt. It's an amazing data set, but they can tell who actually by their putting prowess gained strokes on the field or lost strokes on the field. So the winner of a tournament might, I think Rory McIlroy last week gained 3.3 strokes per round on the field, which is just purely based on his putting ability that week.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. It's a great statistic. They only started it last year, but they have the data for it going back to 2004 because they've been recording shot link data that long. They just hadn't calculated. And they found that among the – there were 323 tour winners in that time, tournaments that were won. And only 11 of those winners led the field in driving distance compared with 47 who led the field in strokes gained putting. But the winner is one thing. Even among the top 10, it was – I think it was 37% were in the top 10 in putts gained in putting, this putting statistic over that time, and only I think 3% were in driving distance of the winner of the top 10 finishers. So it's much more predictive of winning. And on the negative side too, in terms of people who finished outside the top 30 in driving distance, the winners, a third of the winners didn't even finish in the top 30 in driving distance, whereas only 13% of the winners finished outside the top 30 in putting. So it's statistical proof that putting is really where it's at.
And how does so now you have all that statistics about the tour, how does that translate, or is it that obvious how it translates to us, the recreational golfer?
Well,
or what's the lesson we need to learn?
Well, the lesson, which I don't think anybody really doubts, or is that in terms of just improving your score, working on your short game in general and your putting in particular is the fastest, surest way to improve your score.
And I feel, and the thesis behind this entire program is that if you have a strong mental game and you understand strategy, you can also have a better opportunity and a faster path to lowering your score than
Absolutely.
Working on your.
True. Yeah. Now I think I qualified that by saying if you really are interested in improving your score, because I mean there is an undeniable pleasure in just hitting the ball a long way,
or no question,
you know, so that's a legitimate goal and desire in golf that you can't overcome. I think even not just hitting the ball a long way, but there's this feeling of compression on the ball, that feeling where you with an iron that you hit down, you compress it, and it the ball just goes in that just delicious way that every golfer knows, you know, just consistently having that feeling of compression and hitting solid shots. I mean, that is an exquisite pleasure in playing golf that really doesn't necessarily have to have anything to do with score.
You know? Right. Well,
it's
and
recording in and of itself.
Right. And as a recording engineer by trade, the sound of a great golf shot is, you know it. When you hear it, you're like, oh, that sounded great. And you also like, ooh, you hit that thin, didn't you? You know?
Right.
The sounds of the club hitting the ball, They're definitely translatable.
It's part of the pleasure. There's no question about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of score, if you want to just really beat your buddies and, you know, lower your handicap,
game.
The very worst thing that amateurs do putting wise is long lag putts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing where you can probably get the most improvement. Doing drills where you try to hit it 5 yards, 5 feet past, and then 5 feet short, and then even with the hole from 20 feet and then 30 feet and 40 feet. People don't really practice that very much, but if you can avoid three putts, that's sort of the worst putting. That's the most improvable putting aspect for most amateurs, according to Dave Pelt.
I find it fascinating when they're getting ready or when a tournament has started on television and you see guys who are warming up because their tee time's coming up and they're on the practice putting green, where when I watch people on the practice putting green, amateurs, they'll do a 3-footer, then they'll go back and do a 20-footer, and then they'll do, another 3-footer and a 5-footer, and they're all over the place. Where when you're watching these guys practicing on tour, preparing for their round, they'll stand at 6 or 7 feet with 20 balls over and over and over, just the same length over and over and over. Then they'll move to another length. It's fascinating. It's like, just work on the one thing. Don't, because you're not really learning anything by going all over the place. Nor are you getting a sense about the speed of the greens, or you think you might be. But Dr. Joseph Parent of Zen Golf said to me once on the show that, and I've used it forever, is your own personal stimp meter, right? And so what I do is I'll go out to a practice putting green. First I'll ask, are your practice putting greens pretty similar to your greens out there? Yeah, they generally are, because they're maintained by the same people and they're cut the same way. So generally they're close. So what I'll do is I'll find a flat spot on the green. I'll take 3 balls. I won't pick up my head. I won't look at the balls. I won't even pick a target. I'll just take 3 of my most natural strokes in a row and see if all 3 balls end up around the same spot, and then I'll step them off. And if I step it off and it's only 4 paces, this is a pretty slow green. If there are nine paces, this is a pretty fast green. So, someone tell me, we're at 13 on the stimp meter. It's like, I have no idea what that means to me. So I have to set my own stimp meter, from course to course. Like, okay, I know these are pretty fast, so I'm going to have to be a little more aggressive in the way I hit today, or really pull back, which is terrifying when you're trying to do that. But that helps me.
Yeah, I like that. I never heard of that that concept of creating your own personal stimp meter, but that sounds like a very good idea.
Well, there's your next column.
It reminds me, I know Ben Crenshaw, who was one of the greatest putters ever on the PGA Tour, used to didn't practice a lot of putting before a round, but what he did was he didn't usually putt to holes. He would just swing, get a feel for his stroke without a ball, and then just start stroking balls, sometimes with his eyes closed, sometimes with his eyes open, but just to get the feel and then watch them roll out to get a feel of the greens and his stroke and the smoothness. It was very zen-like in his way.
Interesting. Well, I highly advise everyone to track down the article if you want to hear more about what John Paul had to say about these myths. But even more so, I recommend that you check them out weekly on the Wall Street Journal. And you're online at the Wall Street Journal as well, right?
Yes, that's right. There is a paywall at the Wall Street Journal, but most of my columns are available outside the paywall.
Oh, congratulations.
If not, you can follow me on Twitter, JP@JPNewport. I don't really tweet very much, so I'm not an avid Twitterer, but I do put a link up to my column every week so that people that don't have the paywall, when they're behind it, can get to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tweeting. It's a whole other topic. John Paul Newport, thank you so much for spending all this time with me. I think that you and I can probably talk for another 2 hours, and maybe we'll get a chance on the golf course someday. Thanks a lot for coming on to Golf Smarter.
You bet. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks, Fred.
Well, this is the weekend for my annual Golf Buddy getaway, and this year we're headed to Dallas, Texas for three rounds of golf and some Final Four basketball entertainment. We're going to be playing Old American and The Tribute, both designed by our recent guest, Trip Davis. We're also playing the only NFL-themed course in the United States, the Cowboys Golf Club, designed by Jeffrey Brower. Coming up on our next episode, we'll have a conversation with Jeffrey about how we can take advantage of his knowledge and experience in course design and strategy. And what is involved in designing a themed golf course? If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.